You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Felix Walton toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā, kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 1st of March. Not just the 1st of March, it's also the 1st of me, your host Felix Walton. A new semester means a new schedule, and I'm going to be taking over the Monday Wire. Don't fret though, Zoe is still here doing The Wire every Friday. Today I'm joined in the studio by nobody. Jess is at home, unfortunately. Not only is it the first of the month, the first of the week, and the first of me, but it's also the start of a brand new level 3 lockdown, so we're really off to the races this week. Coming up throughout the hour, I spoke to the Green Party co-leader James Shaw on tax inequity, a petition for equitable vaccine distribution, community housing providers, and mistreatment in Parliament. Jess Hopkins interviews Ang Nayar, CEO and co-founder of Strutfit, about how he is revolutionising the footwear industry. Lastly, I spoke to Richard Whitney of the NZ Private Surgical Hospitals Association about the relationship between private and public health. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. If you want to send us a text, you can do that. You can do so on 5395, or you can call us in studio on 309-3879. Anyway, before we get into the show proper, just going to play this quick song, Super Stupid by Funkadelic.
We'll be right back.
time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Today I spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about an Oxfam petition that Green has supported for equitable vaccine distribution, government support for community housing providers, and the rough treatment that Green MP Ricardo Menendez March has faced in Parliament. But first, I asked about a recent statement they had made on tax inequality.
I first wanted to begin by talking about this data that was released last week that shows that a shocking number of wealthy New Zealanders are paying less tax than the average person. What is Green's response to that data? Is it surprising to you?
Look, I'm not wholly surprised at all, I have to say. I think it's really unfortunate, but we've been saying for some time that there is a real problem in the tax system where, people who own assets and wealth but don't, take their compensation in the form of wages, don't pay tax at the same rate that salary earners and wage earners do. The data, and it is experimental, and it is early data, but it does seem to confirm that.
Yeah, so in your statement on that, you said that this data shows a need for progressive tax reform. What does that reform look like in your eyes?
Well, back last year during the election campaign, you may remember that we campaigned for a wealth tax that was designed exactly to deal with this problem, which is in New Zealand we have a tax system that is heavily skewed towards taxing people who work but not people who own, and so we feel that that needs rebalancing.
When people hear about a wealth tax, there's often this knee-jerk reaction, even when they're not the ones who would be impacted by it. Do you know why this is? What would you say to people who are apprehensive of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the wealth tax that we took into the election campaign is that it would have been paid by about a grand total of 6% of New Zealanders. I think the issue is that people sort of think that they are going to fit into that category of very wealthy people one day. Don't want to be taxed. So I think that's the issue, is the vast majority of people actually have, especially in today's housing market, absolutely no chance of accumulating the kind of wealth that would end up with them actually getting caught in the bracket where they would be paying that tax.
Yeah, so it seems to me like the Green Party is very confident that their tax plan is the best way to go. So I'd like to hear you reiterate on this point. Why is this plan the best option?
Well, look, I mean, there are a number of options. We campaigned for many, many years for a capital gains tax, and of course Jacinda Ardern ruled that out in the last term of Parliament. A wealth tax basically is what we would describe as the next best way of trying to bring some fairness back into the tax system and ensuring that the people who are wealthiest, the best, best off, just pay their fair share of tax like everybody else in the country is doing.
So for this next topic, I'd like to chat about this petition from Oxfam that has called for equitable distribution of the vaccine. Could you outline what this petition is all about and why the Green Party is in support of it?
Yeah, look, the basic problem here is that countries like New Zealand, which are wealthier and have access to the vaccine, are starting to roll the vaccine out amongst their populations. But developing countries in the global south are generally not able to access the vaccines in the same way that wealthier developed countries are. So the Oxfam petition is calling on countries like New Zealand to get together and to ensure that everyone around the world is able to get access to the vaccine, not just those of us who are privileged to live in the countries that we live in. And ultimately, that is actually in all of our own self-interest, because none of us is safe until all of us are safe.
Yeah, so when we talk about equitable distribution, what does that look like? Does equitable distribution still allow for the prioritising of certain groups over others, such as those who are at a higher risk?
Yeah, it does. It just means that countries that otherwise wouldn't be able to get access because they're not as well resourced actually have access to the vaccine. You know, the kind of, there is real inequity here. So polio, there was a vaccine for polio that was developed in the first part of the 20th century. But there are still spots around the world in very poor countries where polio still exists, and it's just because those countries haven't been able to get access to the vaccine that they need and to be able to develop systems to roll it out amongst their populations. And so we don't want to see a repeat of that kind of health inequality when it comes to COVID-19.
How would you like to see this petition transform into real-world change? I understand that there's some concern with keeping the vaccine affordable for developing countries.
Yeah, I mean, that basically comes down to the nature of the problem, which is affordability. And there is a piece around intellectual property which needs to get taken care of as well. But the petition really calls on New Zealand to join with other similar countries to make sure that our vaccine program is not purely focused on our domestic population, but also that we work with other countries to make sure that the rollout is indeed truly global.
Thirdly, let's talk about community housing providers. And you're going to have to forgive my ignorance on this topic, but could you explain to me what a community housing provider is and what it does?
Community housing providers are generally charities and trusts that have taken it upon themselves to try and help to solve the housing crisis. The most significant one, you know, most people in New Zealand would have heard of Habitat for Humanity, which is a global organisation, the purpose of which is to ensure that everybody has a home to live in. And so in New Zealand, they've been working for probably just over a decade, maybe almost 20 years now, on, you know, kind of rolling out houses around the country. So it's a little bit like state housing, except it's not provided by the government, it's provided by charitable organisations.
The government has announced that they will be supporting Pacifica peoples in becoming community housing providers. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, so the, you know, people in their own communities know what's best for their own communities. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, look, there are charitable organisations amongst Pacifica communities here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that are very well connected to, you know, at-risk families, people who are in either in overcrowding situations or who are looking for housing. They're very well connected to other Pacific community-oriented charities and to the churches in those communities. And so they're quite well placed to be able to establish themselves as community housing providers. And so the idea here is that the government wants to support that sector to expand.
So your release also notes that community housing providers play an important role in solving the housing crisis. How so? Could you elaborate on that for me?
Well, they supplement the work that the state is doing, and they are often kind of the where innovation happens, if you like. So there are numerous organisations of a range of sizes. Some of them are, you know, very small and might only have a dozen properties or even fewer than that. Others are larger and may have several hundred. And, you know, obviously New Zealand is in the grips of a housing crisis. We're building far too few houses to keep up with demand. House price inflation is absolutely rampant, and that's having a massive impact on, you know, virtually everybody actually in one way or another. And so what we're saying is that we believe that community housing providers and that whole sector can help to add to the efforts that the government is making. And it is going to take all of us, and it's going to take everything we've got to solve the housing crisis. And so we really applaud the move to include the Pacifica communities in that effort.
So lastly, I do just want to briefly touch on the story that's been in the media lately, which is the scrutiny that your MP, Ricardo Menendez-March, has received from opposition. This isn't the first time that he's been nitpicked by the opposition like this, so I wanted to ask for a statement on that. Why does he keep being targeted like that?
Well, in this particular instance, you know, I have to say I thought that some of the undercurrent behind the, you know, people having a go at Ricardo sort of smacked of xenophobia and homophobia, but it really was quite xenophobic, sort of, you know, basically picking him out because he happens to have been born in Mexico rather than being born in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And so the fact is, you know, his family has had some real extreme illness in it, both of his parents. He made a call, and lots of New Zealanders are making similar calls at the moment. Some people know that they're unable to go and see their parents in a state like that. Others are saying, "Look, I'm gonna give it a crack, even with the circumstances that we find ourselves in." And you know, I guess a lot of people just don't like immigrants, and so they sort of saw that as an excuse to pile on.
Yeah, so it is honestly a bit distressing to see this sort of thing happen in politics. Do you think that sort of behaviour has an adverse impact on Parliament's reputation as a whole?
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, and I have to say, I don't think it's very pleasant either, and there's rather a lot of it. Gowrie Gardiman had exactly the same thing, especially in the kind of early years when she first became a Member of Parliament. You know, I was really proud to have New Zealand's first MP, who was a former refugee to Aotearoa New Zealand, who's gone on to become an international human rights lawyer, worked for the UN, and she has had to put up with just the most extraordinary levels of, racism and sexism coming into that role. And I think the problem is people do see that, and they say, well, I don't really want any part of that. And so even people who might support people like Gowrie or Ricardo would find themselves turned off politics and not participating, and that's not good for any of us.
That was Green Party co-leader James Shaw. Thanks for joining me, James. We'll be right back after this.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire.
Oh boy, Mr. Foundation, 48 hours time.
The greatest filmmaking competition in Aotearoa is back, baby. Registrations are open now for Vista Foundation 48 Hours. So whether you're an up-and-coming auteur, a passionate amateur, or you're real good at hitting record on your phone, grab your mates and get ready for your close-up. The shoot weekend kicks off 7pm March 5th till 7pm March 7th. Open to all ages and abilities anywhere in the country. Register now at 48hours.co.nz.
May 1st, 1979. Engineering students at the University of Auckland are in hard hats and grass skirts, their bodies painted with swear words and crude symbols. This is their annual tradition, a mock haka. And when confronted by the activist group He Tawa, this will become the last New Zealand war. Auckland Theatre Company and Auckland Arts Festival present the Haka Party Incident, March 5th to 13th at ASB Waterfront Theatre. Tickets and more info from atc.co.nz.
Heyo, what's in that soup? It looks like a mix of ingredients that, while delicious individually, are even better together.
Ha! That's not soup. It's the Student Radio Network!
Only the freshest ingredients go into the SRN Top 10. Te Te Kau o Rongo Rerekē o Aotearoa gathers up the highest quality, locally grown tracks from New Zealand's student radio stations and brings them together in a fragrant, flavourful and distinctly piquant mix. A chart show for those who prefer to order off menu. Tuesday after 6 on 95 BFM Drive or online at srn.nz. Brought to you by the Student Radio Network.
This is NY State of Mind by Nas.
Hey, yo, Black, it's time. Word is timing. It's time, man. Alright, begin. Yeah, straight out the fucking dungeons of rap, where fake niggas don't make it back. I don't know how to start this. Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm I be kicking. Musician, inflicting composition of pain. I'm like Scarface sniffing cocaine, holding an M16. See with the pen, I'm extreme. Now, bullet holes left in my peepholes. I'm suited up with street clothes. Hand me a 9 and out the beat flows. Y'all know my steelo, with or without the airplay. I keep some E and J, sitting bent up in the stairway. Or either on the corner, betting grams with the CeeLo champs. Laughing at bass heads, trying to sell some broken amps. G-packs get off quick forever. Niggas talk shit, reminiscing about the last time the task force flipped. Niggas be running through the block shooting. Time to start the revolution. Catch a body head for Houston. Once they caught us off guard, the MAC-10 was in the grass. And I ran like a cheetah with thoughts of an assassin. Picked the MAC up, told brothers back up. The MAC spit, lead was hitting niggas. One ran, I made a backflip. Heard a future
chick scream. My arm shook, couldn't look, gave another squeeze, heard it click. Yo, my shit is stuck, tried to cock it, it wouldn't shoot, now I'm in danger. Finally pulled it back and saw three bullets caught up in the chamber. So now I'm jetting to the building lobby, and it was full of children, probably couldn't see as high as I be. It's like the game ain't the same. Got younger niggas pulling the triggers, bringing fame to their name and claim some corners. Crews without guns and corners, in broad daylight, stick up kids, they run up on us. Four fives and gauges, max and facts, same niggas that catch you back to back, snatching your cracks in black. Yo, was a snitch on the block, getting niggas knocked. So hold your stash till the coke price drop. I know this crackhead who says she gotta smoke nice rock. And if it's good, you bring your customers and measuring plots. But yo, you gotta slide on a vacation. Inside information keeps large niggas erasing and they wives basing. It drops deep as it does in my breath. I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death. Beyond the walls of intelligence, life is defined. I think of crime when I'm in a New York state of mind. State of mind.
Your state.
I'm a gangster, drinking Moet's, holding texts, making sure the cash came correct. Then I step, investments in stock, sewing up the box to sell rocks. Winning gunfights with mega cops, but just a nigga walking with his finger on the trigger. Make enough figures until my pockets get bigger. I ain't the type of brother made for you to start testing. Give me a Smith and Wesson, I have niggas undressing. Thinking of cash flow, Buddha and shelter. Whenever frustrated, I'm a hijack Delta. And the PJs, my blend tape plays, bullets are strays. Young bitches is braids, each block is like a maze full of black rats trapped. Plus the Allen is packed, from what I hear in all the stories when my peoples come back black. I'm living where the nights is jet black. The fiends fight to get crack, I just max. I dream I could sit back and lamp like Capone. With drug strips on, all the legal luxury life. Rings flooded with stones, homes. I got so many rhymes, I don't think I'm too sane. Life is parallel to hell, but I must maintain it be prosperous. Though we live dangerous, cops could just arrest me, blaming us for hell like hostages. It's only right that I was born to use mics, and the stuff that I write is even tougher than dice. I'm taking rappers to a new plateau through rap slow. My rhyming is a vitamin, hell without a capsule. The smooth criminal on beat breaks. Never put me in your box if your shit eats tape. The city never sleeps, full of villains and creeps. That's where I learned to do my hustle, had to scuffle with freaks. I'm an addict for sneakers, 20s a Buddha and bitches with beepers. In the streets I could reach her, about blunts I teach her. Inhale deep like the words in my breath. I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death. I lay puzzle as I backtrack to earlier times. Nothing's equivalent to the New York state of mind. State of mind.
Your state of mind. Your state of mind. Your state of mind. Your state of mind.
The government has indicated a progress.
The Wire.
The government's venture investment agency, New Zealand Growth Capital Partners, have announced that they will support the University of Auckland's student entrepreneurship development program, Velocity. One of the ventures to come out of the university's program is Strutfit, who uses computer vision and AI size recommendation technology to take the guesswork out of online footwear shopping. Jess talked to Ang Nayar, the CEO and co-founder of Strutfit, about how Strutfit works and how it has developed since he went through Velocity's development program.
Could you just start off by telling us about Strutfit?
Sure. So Strutfit at a high level is bringing retail into the future. What we've identified is that retailers really want to use technology to deliver the best customer experiences, have efficiencies, ultimately make the most money, but they're not good at technology. I realized this when I was working at a footwear company. And so what we've created is a company which is delivering cutting-edge technology solutions to retailers. And the first place we're starting is in footwear retail, and specifically with the problem of buying shoes online. So if you've ever tried to buy shoes online before, actually, have you ever tried to buy shoes online before?
I have not, but my brother did recently.
How did that go?
Luckily, they did end up fitting,
most of the time they do end up fitting. So about 70% of the time they fit, but then around 30% of the time they don't fit. And that's a massive problem for users and for retailers as well. So we take the guesswork out of that sizing process. So we let people scan their feet at home using their smartphone. All they have to do is put their foot on a piece of paper and take a top-down photo, and we guide them through all that. There's no app downloads. You can use any phone. And then we have a bunch of algorithms which work out the length and width of your feet down to about 1 millimeter of accuracy. And then using the information that the brand has provided to us, we're able to recommend a personalized size suggestion for you in that specific brand and in that specific style. And yeah, that's the current product. People seem to love it. We've had, I think, something like 60,000 people have used it across 10 or 11 retailers. And we're just getting more and more momentum every week.
Why until now, essentially, has there been a lack of high-tech footwear solutions?
So it's two things. One is the technology wasn't ready. So the people who tried to solve this, say, 10 years ago, just wouldn't have been able to do so. Camera phones weren't high resolution enough. Internet speed wasn't fast enough. And then deep learning wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. So deep learning is a form of machine learning where, you know how Tesla cars can like self-drive themselves? It's that technology. So we use the same technology and framework, and that stuff just didn't exist 10 years ago. It only came into the mainstream about maybe 5 years ago. And at that time, it was being used for like really difficult problems like, you know, self-driving cars. And only now can four engineers out of Auckland, New Zealand start working on and using these frameworks for other cool stuff. So yeah, part of it is timing. But then the other part is people weren't really looking to solve the customer experience problem. I think there were too focused on technology. So there's really high-end solutions where there's like hardcore devices, like scanners in store, which you can go in and scan in, but no one really made it easy to scan at home. And then there was another company which would ship out like a sock or some mat to you. And then again, that would give you a very highly accurate scan. But what they weren't doing is looking at the customer journey and being like, hey, when does the customer actually want this information? It's when they're about to purchase the product. So they're looking at the product on the product page and they want that information almost immediately. Because if you have to wait, you're just going to buy a couple pairs of shoes and just return the ones that don't fit. So I think it's the technology, and then it's also our methodology and looking at the customer experience and combining the two let us get ahead of it. People are starting to try copy our solution now, but that's only a mark of success, I think.
Can you explain a little bit more about the technology that StructFit uses and what it's currently able to do?
So the foot scanning is in a pretty good place at the moment. So yeah, we let you put your foot on a piece of paper and take a top-down photo. And that photo basically gets processed by a neural network, which helps us determine what parts of the image are the foot, what parts of the image are the toes, the paper. And after that, we do lots of post-processing, and we use the paper size because that's always the same everywhere, apart from in America because Americans. And we scale that scene. And from that, we can pull out the length and width of your foot really accurately. So that's cool when that works. The next thing we want to do is make it even more convenient. So a piece of paper is sweet, and a lot of people are scanning it. Somewhere between 5 and 15% of a retailer's sales will be using StructFit if they've integrated with StructFit. But we obviously want that to be a lot higher. So the next thing we're working on is letting people use plastic cards from their wallet to scan their feet. So you just place like a loyalty card or a driver's license or a credit card next to your foot and take a photo, and we'll be able to use that object for scale instead, making it a lot more convenient. So that's probably the next big thing in our scanning. But then we're also working on a lot of in-store things from some clients in Australia and Asia Pacific who are like, cool, we love the technology, want to use it online, but also we'd love to use this technology in a store, and you know, what does that look like? So we're working through that at the moment as well.
And have more people been purchasing shoes online because of COVID-19? And has the pandemic helped your business model in any way?
100% people are purchasing more online. So a lot of the in-store sales had to be replaced by online sales. And commerce overall didn't slow down that much, so almost all those in-store sales were absorbed into online sales. Has it helped the business? So in the first instance, it didn't, because everybody got really scared. All the retailers got scared, so they cut all the extra spending. So there was some customers we had on trial which didn't end up converting, which was initially kind of scary. We're like, what do we do? But we planned for the worst case, and we got probably the best case, where we raised some money, hired some more people, and moved a lot faster. And then, so midterm, COVID's probably good for us. People are still a little bit scared and trying to focus on their core business model. But in saying that, the ones who are in a better position are very quickly looking to increase their online experience, because they realize that's probably the only way they'll be trading for a while. And that's where we come in. So we've seen some large brands move a lot quicker with us than we expected. And that's really helped. So yeah, slow in the beginning, and then mid and long term, I think very good for us.
And can you tell us what brands partner with Strutfit, and where can our listeners see Strutfit in action?
So some local brands, if there's guys listening, they can head to Aquila. They do really cool men's dress shoes and sneakers. For females, there's a lot more options. There's Joe Mercer, have some really cool informal female footwear. If they go on the website, they can see everyone we're partnered with, but that'll be male and female. And then a kids brand would be Bobucks, which make beautiful children's shoes. And shopping with kids is always really hard, because you have to take them into a store, and that's a mission in of itself. And then the biggest brand we're probably partnered with right now is a group called Next PLC, so the department retailer group out of the UK, which do something like $4 billion in revenue a year. So that's a big one for us, and we're working through that. So that's also another option. But yeah, if they head to the website, you can see all the partners live there.
How long have you been working on this for, and how did your idea develop over time?
Yeah, ideas always take a lot longer, and businesses always take a lot longer than I think people claim or they say. So for us, like the first part of this started like late 2015 or early 2016. We went through the Summer Lab, which was an entrepreneurship program at the University of Auckland. And then we worked part-time on it for like 2 or 3 years. The final year I was actually at Bobucks leading technology for them. But yeah, we worked part-time on it for ages, validating everything, making sure the investors we were bringing in were happy with the progress, and then getting pretty good terms for that capital raise as well. So, and then in 2019, about March 2019, we raised our first round, which enabled 3 of the staff to go full-time. And then from there, we've just been growing steadily since.
And outside of Strutfit, you've also had a passion for encouraging anyone in Aotearoa that they can be successful, for example, for your Symbolically Kiwi exhibition. So what motivated you to share this message?
Yeah, so that was really random. Like I never set out to be an artist in the first place. So that whole, I guess, progression in my own journey was kind of random, but it was just following something I liked doing. So it was just pursuing a creative endeavor, which eventually snowballed into the largest interactive art exhibition in New Zealand. But yeah, I had a goal, I think, to be in an art gallery. And then while I was talking with a couple of friends, I'm like, well, why not just have the biggest exhibition in New Zealand? Because if you're going to work hard for something, it's going to be probably as much work to do both those things. So you might as well do the harder thing and have a bigger impact. And so while I was working on another art exhibition with this rapper called Machine Gun Kelly, I was like, oh, before I do one overseas, like let's look in New Zealand. There's probably a story worth telling here. And there certainly was. What I was trying to do was combat the tall poppy syndrome, which we have, which I think everyone trying to do anything meaningful goes through, regardless of whether they succeed or not. I feel like a lot of people get put off just by even when they go for something and their friends will make some snarky comments. So I was trying to combat that. And I thought the tall poppy syndrome existed for a couple of reasons. One was people thought that it was like a zero-sum game, and that if someone else succeeded, there was less success for them, which is the opposite of true. Like if Peter Beck is succeeding, then there's actually more successful people because he's created a rocket industry which didn't exist. And then the other part was people thought that these people were something special, and you know, if they could do it, and then the normal person couldn't do it. So I wanted to show that, you know, people like Helen Clark, Joseph Parker, Kane Williamson, Kirsten Dodgen, that they were just still normal people, and we just paint them up to be, you know, extraordinary human beings, and they're really cool people, but they're still just people. So yeah, the purpose of the exhibition was to celebrate their success, but then also show that, hey, these people from different walks of life, from growing up underneath the poverty line in Hong Kong, which was Michelle Dickinson, Nano Girl, that they can go on to achieve success in whichever endeavor and field that they want. And the exhibition was just a way to empower people and deliver that message. And we delivered it to 1,200 people that came through, despite COVID level, I think it was 2.5 at the time. And then the thousands of people, tens of thousands of people who saw online as well.
And just finally, what are your next steps you're looking at for Stratford for, say, the next year or couple of years?
Yeah, so the next steps are, right now we're actually hiring a salesperson. So if anybody is interested, we've already got a couple salespeople, and we just want to keep going on that. So the plan is to scale the internal, the current solution to, as I said, something like $1 million a year, and then start working on our in-store solution, which a bunch of retailers want. And then that'll be the focus for a couple years. Meanwhile, we'll be working on expanding the scanning to go just from scanning feet to scanning the whole body, and then enable sizing suggestions for basically all apparel instead of just footwear. So that's the play. There's plenty of other value adds we can, as we spend more time with retailers, as we partner with more retailers, we're learning more about them and their problems and their needs. So there's always space for us to expand horizontally and add more value in different verticals for them as well.
That was Ang Nayar, the CEO and co-founder of Stratfit.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
This next song is Bingo Master's Breakout by The Fall.
Two swans in front of his eyes, coloured balls in front of his eyes. It's number one for his Kelly's eye, treble six right over his eye. A big shot's voice in his ears, worlds of silence in his ears. All the numbers account for years, checks the cards through eyes of tears. Bingo Masters break out! Bingo Masters break out! Bingo Masters break out! All he sees is a back of chairs, in the mirror a lack of hair, a light round which he fills out. Hear the players all shout, Bingo Masters break out! Bingo Masters break out! Of lager in his hand, silver microphone in his hand, wasting time in numbers and rhyme, 100 blank faces by. Bingo Masters break out, Bingo Masters break out, Bingo Masters break out. And came the time he flipped his lid, came the time he flipped his lid. Full of cards left unfilled, ended his life with wine and pills. There's a grave somewhere only partly filled, a sign in a graveyard on a hill reads Bingo Masters break out.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wives. Wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
A recent study published by Otago University outlined some of the ways that private hospital care can present costs for the public system in the form of aftercare. The study identified that the public system spent about $11.5 million on aftercare for procedures performed in the private sector. The conclusions of that study and the resultant media coverage have been criticised by those working in private hospitals, who say that it doesn't provide enough context for why these costs exist and the relationship between public and private healthcare. I spoke to Richard Whitney, president of the NZ Private Surgical Hospitals Association, about that relationship.
Let's kick off by talking about this study that you're saying is misleading in the way that it presents the relationship between private hospitals and the public system. That study claimed that private treatment cost public hospitals $11.5 million in aftercare. What is your response to this study?
I would be cautious about using the term misleading. I think that the publication provides no context by which those figures are compiled. I haven't seen the data or the research paper itself, so I assume that reference to $11 million is accurate. But in a context point of view, that would be a reasonably modest component of either the private sector's activity levels or, in fact, the DHB's operational levels.
You've noted that there is a lot of cooperation between the private and public systems. Could you outline some of the examples of this in your experience?
Private sector typically doesn't compete with the public sector, and as a result, there is a high level of cooperation and collaboration. A key to that is that a lot of staff, specifically the medical staff, but not limited to, share employers from both a public and a private perspective. So, in fact, we see a lot of staff movement in the clinical skills area between the two sectors. And as a consequence, there is a high level of cooperation and collaboration. The public system accesses the private system to allow them greater capacity and the ability to manage their peaks and troughs of much of the work, and certainly the statistics that are provided from the historical review highlights that, and in fact is at the end of 2020, just short of 20,000 public patients were treated in the private sector under DHB arrangements. So look, the collaboration and the cooperation is certainly alive and well between the two sectors.
Why is such a high number of elective surgeries done privately over using the public system?
From a private point of view, I mean, people will seek to have choice or seek to control their health experiences and interactions. That certainly is one of the key drivers of why people may hold insurance for medical or health activities. But I'd be cautious again with that perception. Those that are insured would represent about 30% of the patients that are treated in the private sector. Many people self-fund. And a lot of that will be about having choice, but also timely access to health services. As the public system becomes more burdened with patient volumes and disruption to their operational environments, such as COVID and the likes, then wait times are extended and people's health will be preferred to be managed by the patient themselves. And where people can, they may well choose to go private over public.
So what are some of the ways in which private hospitals try to alleviate the pressure on the public system? What sort of impact does the private sector have on things like waiting lists?
The waiting list statistics or waiting list status of DHBs is no longer as visible as it used to be. Anecdotally, all DHBs suffer significant levels of patients waiting for their surgery or outpatient clinic attendance. The private sector has, from a capacity point of view, as many operating theatres, as many specialists as the public sector does. And as a consequence, from an elective surgery or elective medical procedure point of view, greater than 50% of all activity in New Zealand is undertaken in the private sector. So without the private sector, you would anticipate that that level of volume and burden would fall back onto the public sector. We don't have patients that are just choosing to have procedures done. These are patients that are clinically determined that a procedure is warranted and would benefit their health and well-being. So it's not as if the problem would go away if the private sector went away.
How do you respond to the argument that the private sector favours wealthier social groups? There's been some concern expressed that growth in the private sector could actually be detrimental to the groups that can't afford private insurance.
I believe that while financial burdens or limitations may well be effective for some people, many are covered and are treated within the private sector. If, for example, their care falls under ACC as a consequence, then that is irrespective of someone's financial status. Similarly, people that would not be deemed to be wealthy do make decisions. We are well aware that some people will choose private care and will add that proportion to their home mortgage, or that family members will help fund their child, their grandchild, or their parents or grandparents for treatment in the private sector. So look, I wouldn't target the financial or the wealth limitations to it. It is really about an individual wishing to access health care at a time that they need to access it.
How do we ensure that we maintain a healthy relationship between public and private sectors, where public hospitals can provide cares to those who need it, while the private sector can alleviate some of the pressure and take that pressure off of public hospitals?
Look, collaboration is key to it. Open communication is key to it. The Ministry of Health certainly had a key role to play during last year's COVID lockdown situation, and that gave clarity and confidence that the public sector and the private sector can collaborate and work together, share resources, plan together. And that is the secret. The burden of healthcare delivery and the risk of having healthcare rationed within the public system will continue into the future. So to pretend it doesn't exist would be a significant burden. Accepting that it does exist and then collaborating would be a key solution.
That was Richard Whitney of NZPSHA. We'll be right back after this quick break.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
I think I'm ready for a B card.
The fact that you call it that tells me you're not ready.
Well, everyone calls it that. You can't just go in and ask for it.
Call it by its name.
Nobody says bosom card. It's a B card. That's fine. That's normal to call it a B card. People don't say bosom.
Some of us remember the old ways.
There's only one place to get a B card. Win, win, win sick prizes. Get incredible discounts and help us stay Auckland's best radio station since forever. Sign up for a B card from just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. Auckland is at alert level 3. The rest of the country is at alert level 2. Travelling in or out of Auckland is restricted. People in Auckland should stay at home, within your bubble. If you have symptoms, call Healthline. Work and learn from home if possible. Keep a physical distance from others and wear a face covering when in public. Stay home. Stop the spread.
Hey, babe.
Yeah, babe.
Traffic's so wild, huh?
Traffic? Yeah, yeah. It's like going somewhere, but also like not going anywhere at all.
I was in some traffic the other day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I just don't rate it at all, eh?
Eh?
The 95BFM Traffic Report, every weekday on Breakfast and Drive, reminding you why you ditched the car. Thanks to Freed, New Zealand's number one e-scooter retailer. Get freed from traffic today.
That was The Wire.
And that's a wrap on The Wire for today. Sorry to dip right after an ad break like that. Kind of rude of me, but what can you do? Thanks to those who spoke with us today, Green Party co-leader James Shaw, Richard Whitney, and Ang Naya. Thank you to all of you who tuned in and for all your texts. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny. You're listening to 95BFM. Thanks for tuning into The Wire. Ka kite. See you next week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.